Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is Tim Bagwell, Dr. Tim Bagwell. And Tim is going to talk to us about why the project that him and I are working on about the student loan debt crisis is called All Exits Closed. So, Tim, how are you today?
I'm fine out here in St. Louis. It's kind of cold today. I suspect it's the same in New York, isn't it?
Yes, it's a little on the chilly side.
We got a little bit of snow.
So we haven't gotten that yet. So, you know, you and I have been talking about this issue for quite a while. We did another show a while back on the history of the problem. So why did you decide to name our project All Exits Closed?
That's funny, because we were discussing so much about it, I forgot I was the one who named it.
You did, yeah.
Yeah, I did, yeah. But we had so much interaction, and I'd forgotten that was, yeah, that had been my idea after several other renditions. But, the idea was is that with the economic boom of the 1960s, 50s and 60s, the middle class was kind of on a superhighway of growing wealth and growing education, and people wanted, and that was access to the middle class. How to become middle class was to become educated, become trained, and move on down to the next exit down the highway to a better home, a better life, a better level of education for yourself and for your children. And with that, there was a demand that education open up to almost as many people as possible. And one of the ways they did that was to offer loans. They offered grants, offered a lot of grants at one time, mostly grants at one time. But then they decided to go more towards student loans over the years. And when they did that, soon after it started to grow with the formation of Sallie Mae, they started closing down the different ways that you could exit your loan, making it basically you got to either die or pay it off. There's the only two ways you're going to exit for the most part. The first one they closed, the first exit that they closed was the biggest one. Excuse me. And that was the bankruptcy. That was exemption from bankruptcy. That happened in 1976, I believe it was. Let me double check that date. In October of 1976, they exempted student loans from discharge under Chapter 7 of bankruptcy, which is where you get out of almost everything. Chapter 7, you know, all your debts get eliminated. And just a little bit of background on bankruptcy. And the Founding Fathers put bankruptcy, they federalized it and put it in the Constitution, in large part to protect themselves first, but also to protect people down the line so they could have a fresh start. If you didn't commit fraud, and, you know, you simply took risks by taking out loans to do business or to build something, and something happened that, made it so your income dropped and you couldn't pay your bills anymore, the idea was that since you were a good person and didn't defraud anybody, you could get a fresh start. And, the biggest part of your loans could be discharged, and you could have that fresh start, very important thing for people to have, so they could start life over again and start contributing to society instead of trying to make those debt payments and not really helping themselves or their family out of that hole. So that was the first thing they did. And then they gradually, through the 80s and 90s, they closed down more and more of the exits and removed more and more of the protections that people had. For instance, all loans, except student loans, have a statute of limitations, which is basically to protect people from companies that don't keep good books. They don't keep good books, and they don't keep after you to collect the debt. At some point, you know, they don't, and or if they sell it to another company and that company doesn't keep track, after a certain number of years, usually seven, no one's contacted you, you're no longer obligated because they weren't doing their due diligence to collect on it. Well, that was removed. In other words, lobbyists made it so that sloppy bookkeeping, sloppy due diligence on the part of the companies making the loans was no longer a problem. If they could find a paperwork and said you owed money, they could come collecting. That was a major one that was taken away. They also started got the right to offset your income tax refund. They could take your, and instead of having that income that you could, you might use it to pay off part of your student loan on your own, they made that decision for you. And if you were in default, they could take your tax refund or a portion of it without going to court. They just simply give you a notice. You could take them to court, but if you don't have the money to pay your loan, you don't have the money for a lawyer to take them to court. Any questions so far? There's a few more other things, but I'll give you time here to, if you have any questions or...
No, keep going.
Okay.
Keep going.
As I go through my notes here, because it is copious how many things
it's
that they
okay.
did. Yeah, yeah. The some of the stuff, because some things were done, so the income tax offset and the bankruptcy and statute of limitations was done through legislation. Other things were done through the courts and then later done through legislation. For instance, protection under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. That's the act that most people are familiar with. When a debt collector calls you and they'll say, this is an attempt to collect the debt. Any information obtained will be used for that purpose. They call that the debt collection mini-Miranda, which, this it sounds like structurally, like the Miranda that one is supposed to receive when being booked for a criminal complaint, the criminal act. And so this mini one, they inform you that if we're talking to you and you tell me you've got a new job coming along, I'm going to be pushing you to make a commitment to make a payment. That's the type of thing that they're, so don't tell them that. Don't tell them that that's coming along. Well, so in the case in Games versus Cavazos, Cavazos was the head of the Department of Education at the time, and Games was a student who was also a National Guard member, and they wanted his payments, even though he was exempt. He had a forbearance based on his duty in the National Guard, but they still wanted his money, and this was in 1990, May of 1990. And he was also a member of the United Auto Workers Union, so they took up the case, and they tried real hard to get the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act applied to the student loan guarantor that was USA United Student Aid Funds and to the Department of Education. And the court ended up saying, no, United Student Aid Funds, though a private entity, was essentially like a deputized federal official. They were a federal agent, and this law did not apply to them. Now, curiously, this is a very interesting case, in that there's a thing called the Student Loan Guarantor Agreement that all student loan guarantors at the time signed, and it contained language to the effect of, I don't have it in front of me, but to the effect of, student loan guarantors will abide by all laws, state and local laws, of state, federal, and local laws of debt collectors. The local wasn't in there, I'm sorry, state and federal laws of for debt collectors. Uh-huh. That document was not included in the court case. Department of Education did not provide it. USA Funds did not provide it. Apparently someone didn't disclose the fact that it existed to the United Auto Workers. And my research indicated that it was never appeared in the court case. If it had, it would have surely caused a different finding. Now, this is just the court in Delaware, the federal court in Delaware, so arguably it's just that district that this would have applied to. That's the way they usually say it in the law journals. If you're doing it in the, I think that's the district, then you would be, then this would likely be governed, if you're bringing a case in this federal district, this case is going to be cited against you. Well, with student loan debt, this, being that it wasn't, at the time, many debts weren't, since they were exempted from bankruptcy, not many student loan cases were being taken up by the courts anyway. And so any place that student loan debt may have been brought up, this probably would have been cited as as an issue. The statute of limitations thing was challenged in Greider versus Cavazos, also 1990. Oh, that's where it was challenged and upheld. And then later on, within 6 months, they exempted them from the statute of limitations. So sometimes there would be a court mm-hmm. case, but uphold the current law. Then 6 months later, the lobbyists have gotten to D.C. and they get that law overturned.
They get another law in place that exempted them.
So, also in 1990, a very bad year, student loans were exempted under Chapter 13, which is the more parceled out form of bankruptcy. You don't get out of everything, but this way, you're getting out of no student loan debt. Okay? So that was one of the things that happened there. Here's a funny one. Again, in 1990, it's getting near the end of the year now, November, and they amended the Federal Debt Collection Act to require a 7-year repayment period for a guaranteed student loan to qualify for consideration for discharge under bankruptcy. So the forbidden, the exit close on bankruptcy is not 100% airtight. There have been maybe 7 or 8 cases where they've been included. Very tough to include. And one of the things they did was to say, well, if you've been in repayment for 7 years, we may consider it. Again, how anachronistic, since if you're in repayment for 7 years on your student loan, you're probably not going to be filing for bankruptcy.
Okay.
You're probably up to date. Not many people are going to be qualifying for that. So then in 1991, student loan guarantors could garnish wages. So essentially, and there may be a couple more out here, I look at my notes, but essentially all these exits were closed. No other, if you have a credit card, all these exits are open to you. Chapter 13, Chapter 7, those are all available to you. If the collector calls, they've got to obey certain rules about when they call and where they call, where you're located, when they can contact you. Mm-hmm. Taking a little drink of soda here. Mm. So the substantially, they were separated out. They were separated out from them. Now, what I contend in my research is that what's happened is that by the separating out, we essentially have a bill of attainder situation. Bills of attainder were also in the Constitution, and bills of attainder were bills passed by the legislature. This is famous in England in particular. Bills passed by the legislature that would say, Joe Blow and his family, Joe Blow having committed things that we don't like, and his family are hereby banished and their property seized. Or Joe Blow is, put in prison, or Joe Blow, his rights are denied, right? And under the Constitution, not the British but ours, it's the denial of life, liberty, or property. So, putting them in jail or, sentencing them to death or taking property or and other forms of liberty, the ability to run for public office, for instance, these things can be denied by bill of attainder, by a legislative act, and they were not allowed to take it to court. So what I can tell you go ahead.
All of this stuff was done incrementally. As it was done in increments, the federal government, meaning the Congress, the Senate, the House of Representatives, must have known about this. Did they let everything that all of this stuff that you just talked about, did they just let it go through without much questioning?
Yes. So for the most part, on these actual acts that were passed, went through without much questioning. When they would usually investigate student loan activity was when executives of student loan guarantor companies would have large. They would be not for those are not student loan guarantors were ostensibly not for profit, but the executives would have these enormous salaries. The executives would have these enormous salaries. Yeah.
So usually that's when they were investigated. They were investigated, of course, when, you know, money was being spent or money was going elsewhere. At a high level, not at the low level. They didn't look at the low level. When they did look at the low level, when they did have discussions about these exemptions, there were some. There was always the contention that you're dealing with a population that, you know, of young people who, you know, may not get their jobs, may be lazy, and won't pay their debts. But consumer advocates testified and gave data indicating that student loan defaults were no different than the other default or defaulters. The defaulter was no different.
Okay.
The rate of default on student loans was about the same as the rate of default on credit cards. So the argument that, you know, this had to be done especially because of the population was part of why I contend it's a bill of attainder, because they essentially, you know, you've heard the phrase student loan deadbeat. Okay. Student loan deadbeat. Right. And so they've stigmatized the population and therefore justified passing legislation against them in particular because of, because they've been identified as deviant. You know, this is what happens.
Okay.
The population is defined as deviant, and then you go regulate it by taking away its rights that it may have had, that they may have had, say, with credit cards or their houses or things like that.
So today we're looking at $1.3 trillion with 44 million Americans in debt. And that's not counting the people who co-signed the loans. Okay.
Right.
So when all of this stuff first came into being, do you have any figures on what the debt was when all of these pieces were put in place?
I don't have that in front of me. I can tell you this, though. In 1980, when Reagan came into office, there was a major change. The biggest change was this, was that before Reagan, the student financial aid programs were 70% grants, such as the Pell Grant, and 30% loans. And 30% loans. Within a couple of years, they completely flipped that to 30% grants, 70% loans.
Mm-hmm.
So people could make money off of it. Nobody was making money off the grants. That's just going to people who qualify and who keep on qualifying by keeping the grades up, keeping their enrollment going and keeping the grades up. That's how the grants work. A perfectly legitimate way of doing things. But then they decided to flip that and help these student loan organizations and Sallie Mae make money off the system, and opened up a huge market. And this also arguably caused inflation in the higher education market in general. Tuitions went up, as did college construction and college payrolls for administrative staff. More deans and vice presidents than we ever saw before.
Right. So when you did your PhD thesis on the student loan debt crisis, that was around 2000, correct?
Right.
Okay. Now it's 1.5 trillion now. Do you have a figure how bad it was then?
It was probably in the half trillion range. I don't have that figure. I'm sorry. I deal mostly with the policy side, not so much with the data side of the level loans, because it all comes down to individual borrowers eventually, and individual borrowers who have their money taken. Individual borrowers, you know, who also may not have health insurance or who have expensive health insurance. Individual borrowers who may be on public assistance of some kind. Individual borrowers who may have other debts. Substantial debts, you know, and And this is the my main concern is what the effect is on the individual and how these policies hurt the individual, in this way. But your point is more than well taken. 44 million people, over $1 trillion, you know, it makes no sense to have that much debt soaking up the incomes of the middle class, of the new emerging middle class.
Right. You know,
they need to be spending. They would be better spending that on their mortgages and on cars and other things that would help them, rather than servicing a debt.
Now, from your observations, do you think that the middle class, meaning the 20 and 30 age groups, do you think that they're just about non-existent at this point?
I'm sorry, the middle class is non-existent, or what?
Do you think that the millennials, the people in their 20s and 30s who
mm-hmm.
went to college, who have debts, would you say that their chances to attain, you know, status at a higher rung in society has just about been eliminated?
It's been extremely hampered. Only those probably who whose parents are well-heeled enough to help them out.
Okay.
You know, that's why they're living at home in part. They're living at home because
right.
they have this student loan debt, and they don't have, and I mean, it's not been helped by the decline in wages since, you know, the wage growth has also been one of the problems. And slow wage growth is just another form of theft, and it keeps people in this debt peonage. We have a kind of debt peonage here.
Right. So
a debt peonage set up by the government.
Right. So we just had another nationwide election, the midterms for 2018, and again, very few candidates even addressed this issue. And I'm sure they all knew about it. How, from your estimation, how far can this go without a total catastrophe, collapse, calamity? What do you see happening?
I don't think we see much happening until there's another financial crisis in which it comes down to helping the consumer versus helping the banks. And it should have happened last time. I mean, so they tried to help the people who were underwater with their homes, but that didn't really help that much. And part of helping with that and helping with everything else is taking away, eliminating the student loan burden. Now, two ways of doing that is just
right.
restoring bankruptcy, and then people just file when they can file, right? Another way would be
right.
to set up a system for forgiving the loans. You know, but
right.
there's some political charges on that. You know, as far as the catastrophe, I wonder, I don't think, again, we haven't seen this kind of organization in the United States, but how many people have to stop paying their debt? What percentage have to stop paying on their debt for it to become a financial crisis for the institutions that made the loan? I don't know what that figure looks like.
Right. And do you
right.
think we're heading in that direction?
I don't know yet. I think a lot depends on how events in this recent election and its aftermath are going to affect the people, how the people
okay.
are going to feel about the treatment that they're going to be getting from the government and how the government treats them in general. I think that's really it, is that your obligation – you know, this isn't like signing up. This isn't like draft dodging. This is a debt that you're not being fairly treated on. You know.
Okay.
Yeah, a debt.
Now,
a number of people made fine salaries and incomes and have secured their children's and grandchildren because they were executives in the student loan business. But in the meantime, it's a debt burden to members of the middle class.
Now, you had run for Congress in 2004 and 2008, I believe. 2010. Right. So you had at that time gotten your PhD, where you wrote about this in your thesis. In 2004 and 2010, as you listened to other candidates as you were running in Southern Illinois, did you ever hear of any other candidates bringing this issue up?
Not really. It's a hard congressional issue to campaign on because you're dealing with a smaller population. I was dealing with a more rural district where not quite as many student loans. And, you know, it's hard to message that out. Also in a rural district where the media, you know, so it's like any other issue. There has to be media to support it. And there has to be enough of the constituents that are concerned about it. I think that this is a statewide and a federal issue. So it's a federal, U.S. Senate and a presidential campaign issue.
Okay.
So the funny thing is, if a president was able to do an executive order forgiving all student loans, he would be smart to do that a little bit before his second term would be was his second election. Because it would more likely guarantee him, you know, a victory. But I don't think that's going to happen either.
You know what I think? I've read a couple of articles where they said that there was a problem in the with the voting booths, with the voting machines in the state of Texas.
Right.
And Ted Cruz's win might be subject to a little controversy. Okay. So there wasn't too much of a difference between O'Rourke and Cruz as far as the vote total is concerned. Okay.
Right.
So if O'Rourke only lost by a small percentage, and I read there were 4 million people in the state of Texas that have student loan debt. So that makes me believe that candidates are catering to the donors rather than to the voters. What do you think?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
I also want to note that there's information out there that the Koch brothers definitely don't want to see bankruptcy restored to the student loan program. So,
wow.
So there's some far right moneyed interests that don't like the and I don't know why that is, except you know you keep people in debt.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I think that's a big part of it.
You know, we've talked. This is our second show, and we've talked about the origins of the student loan debt crisis and why we call our project All Exits Closed. I think the next progression, the most logical progression, is why the tuition rates in colleges, why is it so unaffordable without loans and people mortgaging their future? Would you say that was the next logical step?
Yep. I don't think so.
Okay,
great. That's part of the vested interest. That's part of the vested interest. All those jobs that were created at the universities. So.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, so in our closing moments, Tim, do you have any final thoughts?
I think mostly we wrapped it up with you know, what any crisis would be. There has to be another financial crisis for the people to realize that they're not getting a fair shake with the student loans versus what the banks get. Banks get all the breaks.
Right. and did you see this coming in 2008?
See what coming? This. I think when you remove this many rights from people, this many options, there's going to be a crisis at some point, a crisis of fairness, if nothing else, a crisis of equity and of equal protection, if nothing else.
Okay.
You know, yeah.
So Our new podcast is called All Exits Closed. We have a website, allexitsclosed.com. So anybody listening to it, please check out the website. And, you know, I'm interested in knowing how, what reaction the audience has, you and the audience have to this, to these podcasts, and also to the website. So if you could send an email, it's on the website. We also have a place for you to send me videos, and maybe if you're interested in doing podcasts with me, you know, contact me and we could do a podcast. But hopefully, you know, we could build up enough support and awareness in this country that we could make this a viable
issue.
Viable subject, yes, for the 2020 election. So, Tim, thank you so much. This
thank
is Tim
you.
Bagwell. You're Dr. Tim Bagwell, and you're in St. Louis. I'm Cynthia Pooler, and I'm in the state of New York. So if you like All Exits Closed, we have a Facebook page, and we have a Twitter account, and we also have a GoFundMe page if you want to kick in a dollar or two. So we will talk again. So thanks, Tim, for, you know, being on All Exits Closed. And thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day. There's more to
come.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.